It is 7:47 in the morning. The program's up front. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert, and it is election day, at least in a big swath of the country. Some fairly high-stakes primaries taking place that have had Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez stomping in areas as far away as Kansas and Michigan. Joining us to give us the lay of the land, John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
So let's start closest to your neck of the woods, Michigan. Abdul El-Sayed has become the progressive standard bearer in state politics. He is in the primary for the governor's office. What are his politics? Who's behind him? What does his coalition look like?
He's a really fascinating candidate. The thing that a lot of media fixates on is the fact that he would be, if elected, the first Muslim governor in the United States. And there's no doubt of that. But there's an awful lot more to this guy that as people get to know, it really does make an impression. He's a Rhodes Scholar, a guy who taught public health in the universities, and then was drawn back at around age 30 to Detroit to take over as the head of their health department. This is at a time when Detroit was under so-called emergency manager control, which meant local folks weren't in charge. They were beginning to take back control of the city. Health department had just been obliterated. And he made a really big reputation as a guy who rebuilt the health department, did all sorts of innovative things like made sure that every kid in the school system got glasses, made sure that the water in the schools was healthy and clean, which, of course, in Michigan with Flint is a real big issue. And so got this reputation as a guy who could hit the ground running and do things. And then, to the surprise of a lot of folks, announced he was running for governor. And obviously he, you know, wasn't tied into the long-term political structure of the state. He's an academic and a public health guy rather than a traditional politician. But he quickly pulled together a message that really in many ways parallels a lot of what you've heard from Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Single-payer health care, $15 wages, a clean, renewable energy plan, all sorts of public health initiatives that would logically extend from this guy, and just a host of other proposals, legalizing marijuana, ending the drug war, criminal justice reform, making Michigan a welcoming state for immigrants, just up and down a very progressive agenda. And he was way down in the polls, but there is some reasonable evidence to believe, if you look at some of the patterns of polling, that he's really been closing the gap in the last couple of weeks. So there's a lot of interest in his candidacy.
Michigan is a state that's not safe for Democrats. The current governor is a Republican. I would imagine one of the arguments deployed against Abdul El-Sayed is the viability argument, whether he can win in the general election.
Of course, but that's always something that's thrown at candidates who propose to go a different way. Now, remember, Michigan is a battleground state, but the Democrats have lost a lot there. They've lost the governorship a couple times. They lost the last presidential race there. They've lost a lot of congressional seats. They obviously lost control of the legislature to the extent that Michigan, the founding home of the United Auto Workers, became a so-called right-to-work state. And so what Al-Sayed is saying is, that, you know, you can't just go with the existing electorate. You really need to build it out to draw a tremendous number of new voters into the process. And he's doing this with, I was up there about a week ago looking at it. It's quite remarkable. A campaign that is heavily focused on young voters, on voters in the cities who have not always been mobilized, but also, amazingly enough, really hard work as a guy coming out of Detroit in some of the most rural parts of Michigan, reaching out to the rural, low-income, poor folks with a message about renewing rural schools, ending privatization efforts, and also a big, big focus on something that hasn't been done in any other state, and that is to develop a state broadband service, effectively to make the state a participant in providing broadband for all, so that people aren't charged a lot for it, so that it is 100% available everywhere. And there, again, some evidence, we'll see what the results show tonight, that has generated a lot of support in areas that you might not traditionally think of a Democrat as doing well. And so he's got a theory for how he wants to do it. And again, it does seem to have excited quite a few folks.
I want to move on to some of the other races to watch tonight. There is one congressional seat that will be determined tonight before being determined again in 3 months. This is Ohio's 12th congressional district. As I said, the election's only going to determine the next 3 months. Is it something worth caring about?
Sure it is. You know it is, because Donald Trump himself is quite obsessed with it. Look, this is a race to fill a seat of a Republican member who stepped down. And obviously, there's always the pressure not to call special elections when they get closer to the regular election. But there's two reasons why they should be called. First off, you should always fill open congressional seats, because Congress tends to stay in session even into election seasons. And there's plenty that Congress will be deciding. So those people deserve and need representation. But beyond that, this race becomes a real, you know, bellwether. It's a very Republican seat. It's a seat that has been essentially Republican for the last century, with a, you know, brief break in the 1930s, and I think another brief break in the 70s. But, you know, essentially, if the Democrat, a guy named Danny O'Connor, were to win this seat tonight, that would be probably the strongest signal we've gotten yet. Even stronger, maybe, than Connor Lamb in Pennsylvania a few months back, that there is this blue wave, i.e., that Democrats are able, in this moment of Trump, in this moment of a lot of chaos and instability in our politics, to win in areas that have been traditionally Republican. So it would be a big deal.
That Connor Lamb victory got spun two ways in politics. One was exactly as you described, signaling that Republicans are vulnerable because Trump is the figurehead of their party. The other, kind of within Democratic strategy circles, was, hey, this is a fairly centrist candidate who's appealing to the reasonable voter in the center. His victory, the fact that he's the one who flipped a Republican district, is a rebuttal of Bernie Sanders-style politics within the Democratic Party. Who is Danny O'Connor? What does he represent within the Democratic spectrum?
Yeah, well, Danny O'Connor tends to be another of these guys who is, you know, I would say center-left. I mean, he's not, certainly not sending a lot of conservative signals, but he's not running as, say, a pure Bernie Sanders message. So, yeah, you'll hear that spin. But here's the important thing. I wrote a lot about the Connor Lamb race, and I thought that a lot of the analysis was way off. It is true that Connor Lamb sent some moderate signals. There's no doubt of that. And you could take that in, and people want to talk about that, have every right to do so. But it's also important to recognize that he ran strong against the Bush tax cut, or against the Trump tax cuts. He ran strong against, a lot of the initiatives of the Trump administration on a host of issues. And the fact of the matter is, he was talking about health care. He was talking about, protecting Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid in big ways. This was not a, kind of old school, new Democrat centrist message. This was a pretty progressive message on economics. And so you're saying something similar with Danny O'Connor. And I think the important thing to understand, as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says, is that, she's mindful that not every district in America is the same. But there ought to be some core messages coming through, and those ought to be more progressive core messages. And I would argue that those who would try to spin a Danny O'Connor win, if he wins, as some sort of center-right thing, or that the Democrats should go more conservative, I think that's something of a false narrative. What's mobilizing people, what's getting people out in a lot of these special elections, and really around the country, appears to be a real distaste for Donald Trump, number one, but also an interest in a Democratic Party that offers more than it has in the past, especially on a host of economic issues.
Well, speaking of races that Donald Trump has intervened in, let's move to Kansas, which is having an across-the-board primary today. Trump has been stumping for Kris Kobach, the Secretary of State, erstwhile member of the now dismantled Electoral Integrity Commission that the Trump administration put together, and probably the person that Republicans in Kansas politics are most afraid of winning the nomination, because there's concern that he's such a firebrand and a idiot that he would not be that electable. Why do you think Trump is intervening in the primary?
Well, I'm not going to correct you. I'm going to correct you in saying idiot, okay?
A judge ordered him to re-up his legal education.
No. The problem with him is he isn't an idiot. I wish he was. The problem with him is he is one of the slyest, most dangerous schemers in American politics. You may, in fact, be right that he doesn't keep his legal education up. But the thing about Kris Kobach is this is a guy who is, you know, kind of always on the make politically. He's the guy, do you remember when he had his picture taken with Donald Trump? He went to meet with Trump because he's trying to get some administration gig. And, you know, he had his resume and all of his paperwork with him and everything. I mean, he's making his move always. And you should keep an eye on him because he's the kind of guy who keeps elbowing his way into things with a strategy, obviously, for going big, going national. And he makes Trump, in many ways, look mild. Kris Kobach is extreme on a host of issues, particularly immigration issues. Now, he's running for governor of Kansas, and a lot of people who don't live in Kansas might think that the state is, you know, like this super conservative place. In fact, just 4 years ago, in the Republican wave year of 2014, the Democrats came relatively close to taking the governorship, in part because Sam Brownback, the sitting governor, was just a disaster on economic issues and tax issues and budgeting. But Kobach is well to the right stylistically and in a host of, you know, issues from even Brownback. He's running in the primary against the guy who took over for Brownback. Brownback got a Trump administration appointment. And if he beats the sitting Republican governor in this primary, then I think there's a really good chance, a striking chance, that the Democrats could take the governorship of Kansas. And you have to understand what a big deal that would be. This is, you know, Kansas being a variation, frankly, on a lot of other states around the country where you have, you know, gubernatorial elections this year. If Democrats start to take governorships in some of these, you know, traditionally more Republican states, as you go into the playout of the 2020 census and redistricting, these are hugely significant races. And so the Kansas one's a very big deal. If Kobach wins it, Democrats are going to concentrate a lot of attention there and potentially win the governorship.
And do you think Trump intervening for Kobach is just a, you know, the fact that they have some kind of relationship, or do you think he sees some other political angle in doing it?
I think Trump loves Kobach. You know, okay, yeah, like just thinks he's the best thing going. Because remember, Donald Trump is obsessed, probably more than anything else, with the so-called legitimacy of his 2016 victory. He still tweets about it all the time, claiming that, you know, he won big, one of the biggest victories in history. And if that wasn't reflected in the popular vote, it was only because there was so-called fraudulent voting, like all this, you know, people who voted illegally and obviously didn't vote for him. Well, the generator of those theories, the guy who literally gives Trump his numbers, is Kris Kobach. So, I mean, I think Trump's intervention there is, you know, completely explainable and frankly rooted completely in Trump's obsession with, we who follow politics know, was not a big victory, but in fact, you know, a very narrow break for him politically, in which he lost the popular vote by almost 3 million.
All right. John Nichols, it'll be exciting to see what happens. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure, my friend. Take care.
John Nichols is Washington correspondent for The Nation.